Hey, it's Leslie coming at you today on Easter. First of all, happy Easter. And if you're not listening to this on Easter Sunday, happy Easter season. Coming at you today with a replay of an episode from last April. You know, I get asked all the time who my favorite guest has been, or my favorite episode. And while I have had a ton of great guests, I've had a lot of friends on, I've had a lot of people that I've met that have become friends be on, and, you know, every episode is special, but there was something about this one, and this is the one that I always mention, and it is from the inspiration series that I periodically put up. And this is with my friend Denise Everett. And, you know, Denise is special. She's a former teammate of mine. She's 11-time Ironman. And in this episode, she is talking about her life before, during, and after a head-on collision with a truck while she was riding a scooter that killed her, actually. She actually died a couple times, but came back and ended up a quadriplegic. Her will to live and approach to life and her recovery, and the sheer awe that she has that she lived to hold her grandson will amaze you and encourage you to live life to the fullest every day. So without further ado, my favorite episode from this last year with Denise Everett. I'm Leslie McShane, and this is the new Old You, a place where women 50 and over are able to come together to figure out who they really are, what they want, and how they're going to get there. If you're like me, you're ready to do some rediscovering, and that's what we're going to do together, with people who know, and most importantly, with each other. It's time to take a little time for yourself, because honestly, you deserve it. Hi, it's Leslie, and I am jumping back into what I call the inspiration series for today's podcast. Today, I am talking with Denise Everett, who, surprise, was also a teammate of mine back in the day when we raced for Children's First out of Indianapolis. But Denise's athletic talents didn't start or end on the bike. She finished top five in her age group in all 11 Ironman races she entered. She has run six other marathons, even qualifying for the Boston Marathon with her time in the running leg of the 2013 Louisville Ironman. She ran her fastest marathon in Chicago in 3 hours and 21 minutes when she was 44 years old. But she has always enjoyed training the most, and I personally know that she has run the hell out of the roads around her Louisville home. On top of that, she is probably one of the smartest people that I know. She graduated with a BA in psychology from Rutgers, a BS in biochemistry from Rutgers, and a JD from the U of L Law School. Professionally, she is a partner of counsel at Dinsmore and Shull, and she is an intellectual property lawyer with a focus on patent drafting and prosecution in the biotechnology, pharmaceutical, and medical and chemical arts. Say that three times really fast. Labor Day weekend a few years ago, Denise was involved in a head-on collision with a truck while riding a scooter. I'll let her tell the story, but the fact that she's able to sit and talk with me today on the podcast is an absolute miracle. She has been an inspiration to so many of us that know her. Her grit and determination to do everything that she can to recover from the accident have just been amazing to watch. So welcome to the podcast, Denise Everett. Hi, Denise.
Hey. Good to see you again.
It is great.
That's funny. Reminding me of those old bicycle team days.
That was so long ago. It feels like yesterday, but it was a long time ago.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
We were a lot younger then.
Oh, seems like it. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will have to admit that I was a little afraid to ask you to be on the podcast because I didn't want you to think that I was being super personal about having you talk about your accident. And, but your story is completely inspirational to
interesting you say that, because honestly, I think that it's being very matter of fact about the accident is the way that I have been, the way I have processed it myself, and the way I talk about it. I may be at some advantage in that because I don't remember it. Right. I have no actual memory of the accident or about a week after. Mm-hmm. My memories after that for about the next week or two were highly bizarre because of the medications I was on.
Right.
So I woke up 2 weeks after the accident, still thinking I could run, still thinking I could walk, arguing with the medical staff there when they would come and say, "What are you doing here?" It was part of their question series to see how aware you were. Mm-hmm. Was, "Do you know why you're here? Do you know this?" You know, I'd be like, "Well, I just got done with the run and right. I was still back several weeks
right.
earlier."
Right.
So,
right.
You know,
well, before we get into everything that happened after, tell us a little bit about before the accident. You know, I know that you were an Ironman.
Yes.
Tell us how you got into all of that and, you know, what you did and what your dreams and goals and plans for life were.
So Ironman, well, my dreams and goals and plans for life always centered around family mm-hmm. and what my dreams and goals and plans for my children were. I think that's probably ubiquitous for all us women that also have careers and children, but it's not about us necessarily. But I love the Ironman races. My sister called me. I was almost, I would think I was 48, and she was 49, getting ready to turn 50. She was going to be 50 in like 8 months. And she was also retiring as a colonel in the Air Force. And she was like, wow. "Denise, I'm totally bored with life. I need something to do, a plan for me to do on my 50th birthday or thereabouts. And I want you to do it with me. We got to come up with something." Mm-hmm. So I was like, "How about one of those ultra marathons? You know, something that I could do." And she's like, no, yeah, I can't run that fast. I can't run that far. I don't have the hardware." She comes back with, "How about an Ironman?" And I was like, "Oh my God, you're going to make me get back in the pool again. I haven't been in the pool since we were kids." I was of the four sisters by far and away the worst swimmer. Mm-hmm. They were all Americans, got scholarships in swimming. I was too little, too small. I really am not, never have been, will never be much of a swimmer. And there's an irony in all that at this point. It's the only thing I could do after the injury, but which is kind of funny. But so Deb talked me into doing the first one, and we did Austin. It was like right after she turned 50 and I turned 49. That was the first one we did. So now and that was like 2010, I think. So 11 years ago, and yeah, because I'll be 60 this year. So, and that got us going. And that first one, I was so scared. I had no idea how to do an Ironman. Absolutely not. Overtrained. Oh my God. Made all the classic errors. Just was exhausted at the race because I had completely hammered my body. I was like, okay, to do a marathon and 112 miles on a bike and a 2.4 mile swim, you must have to go out and do those distances, you know. The cross training enhancement that you get from each one, swimming, not so much, you don't get so much cross training, but between the bike and the run, when I finally got good at it, I was doing maybe 3 runs a week, 3 bikes a week, and 2 swims a week. So not really much more of a time investment than what we did as bike racers.
Right.
You know, it was, or people do as master swimmers. Mm-hmm. Runners, they don't have that much time investment because you just can't be out hammering the ground mm-hmm. that kind of time. Right. But definitely it was not nearly the time burden I thought it would be, or the, you know, damage to my body that I originally was undertaking. It's not like that.
Right.
So it's something I think we all can do, but it was fun. And it taught me a lot about setting goals and, in the face of everyone saying there's no way that a person can do these 3 things and not end up like we all remember that old Wild World of Sports video of the gal coming in. I think it was only the second time women had even been in Kona Ironman, the world championship of Ironman. And she just lost all bowel control and everything, like 20 feet from the end. And it looked for all the world like she, and she got past, she had been in the lead. It looked like she was going to die.
Right.
It wouldn't let anybody help her. And that was my view of Ironman. And I think a lot of us had that view for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, this is something that could kill me. It's so crazy. It's so freaking crazy. Nobody,
and I have volunteered to do it.
Yes. And my sister's got me into this figures, but it ended up being something that if you break into little pieces and you logically put them together again and follow, trust your training, I think was the thing that is the mantra of almost all Ironman athletes. Trust your training. Don't, you know, this isn't a wheel you have to reinvent. This isn't, you know, people have been doing this now and they have recorded successful training regimens that will end up in a successful Ironman. Use that. Use that. They have these 4 months to Ironman or whatever you want to pick, but get that book and trust the training because it really does work. So that's what I did. And you know, it parlayed well into recovery from the accident. It really did.
So tell us
the same thing.
Tell us about the accident. What happened?
We were staying at our creek house, we called it, on Labor Day, just hanging out. We had been fishing. We had gone swimming in the creek with the dogs earlier in the day. That's about where my memory stopped. We'd gotten on the ATVs, headed back to the cabin. I remember doing that. And then after that, I don't have a memory. So what I'm told, and I've seen all the police reports, we decided to take our little pair of Honda Zoomers, which are a little scooter. They don't qualify as motorcycles. They're 49cc. We had decided to take those out and go explore some of the southern Indiana roads. This was kind of near the Knobs, is where we had the creek house, Mountport. And then, so you're right there. I think we were going up one of the Knobs to Elizabeth, but we were on Audubon Road and I'm going, JT's probably 100 yards in front of me. I didn't like being right behind him because he kicked up dirt in my face. So I was about 100 yards behind him. We're just cruising around looking at graveyards. I think he says we stopped and looked at some graveyards. I don't remember doing that, but back on the road. And he said he's on a straightaway up the hill and he sees a pickup truck coming very fast toward him. And he's knows I'm behind him, but I'm on a blind curve. And he said he's trying to get the guy's attention. He said the kid who was driving, it's only, you know, the kid driving was the only one in the car, gunned it. Instead of slowing down, he gave him one of these screw you sort of things, gunned it when he went by him. So now JT said at that point, he was just waiting to hear the collision because he knew the way he was going, he was going to swing into my lane.
Oh, that's frightening.
And so that's exactly what happened. The pictures show that my scooter was hit in my lane and dragged across the road back into his lane. And that's where he parked. I was up the road a little bit on the ground. The bike, the scooter at that point was under the left part of his car. He claimed I was in his lane. With all my years of riding bikes, I was not a person to cross that center lane. I yelled at people who crossed that center lane, especially JT.
Especially in a blind turn. You never would have done that.
No, and I was going uphill. So, you know, I was going slowly too. So there's no way. And so my lawyer later looked at the pictures and said, look at this. You can see where your rear view mirror dragged made a crevice, dragged across the road where it hit the ground. It then was dragged across the road. You can tell where he hit you. So not that I hold no, the boy was 19 and it wasn't too long before that, maybe a year before that, my 19-year-old son was in a pickup truck with three other young people in the front seat and hydroplaned in the rain, hit another car, launched that one into the side of a house. Airbags went off and everyone could have been seriously injured. He was going too fast for the conditions. So, you know, that age group, young men at that age group, I couldn't be angry. I couldn't be, and he stopped and he cried and he was, pretty broken up. But I didn't appreciate him saying that I was in his lane, but you know, I hold no ill will toward him. And it was an accident. He probably learned that, you know, there's other people out there. You can't just drive. We've seen that when we used to ride our bikes up the knobs. Mm-hmm. You were always careful about the cars coming down because they always swung into the other lane around the curves. You need to be careful. You need to keep under control of your speed, even coming down a big hill. And hopefully he learned that.
Yeah.
But I never spoke with him. I wrote him a note, but I didn't hear back. Not that I expected to. He's probably like, what in the world do I say?
Right.
So that was that. And I was helicoptered to University of Louisville Trauma Center from the accident site. I died twice on the helicopter. So I feel like, and the guy, you know, the cardiologist who met us at the hospital, at the trauma center, came by to see me later. And he said, you know, I had to come by and see this woman that I saw at a time when, you know, wasn't your best moment. But he said, you have the cardiovasculature of someone in their 20s. And that's why you're alive. So there you go. There's what all that racing,
yeah,
all that bicycle racing, running, yeah, Ironman, yeah, swimming, all that stuff.
Getting you ready.
Kept me alive.
Right.
Through that accident, mm-hmm, that trauma. And, you know, and then beyond that, I credit all the great people in physical therapy there at Fraser Rehab, yeah, Institute. Yeah.
So you were out of it for about 2 weeks, you said?
Totally out of it. Yeah. I mean, I came back into consciousness about a week later. I can remember the wild, wacky thoughts I had. But one of the things they do when you've had a head trauma like that, because I did have a, what they call a TBI, traumatic, mm-hmm, brain injury, had 3 skull fractures, dummy was not wearing a helmet. I have no idea why I wasn't wearing a helmet on that thing. Mm-hmm. No idea whatsoever. Because I always wore a helmet on a bicycle. Why wouldn't I,
right,
put one on the scooter? But I was, right, not wearing a helmet. I had 3 skull fractures. I had what they called a near internal decapitation, which is back here where I was hit real hard. And a lot of trauma at C5-7, cervical discs.
Yeah.
So one of the things that when you have a TBI, they do when you get to a trauma center is give you seizure suppressing medication. Those also tend to be hallucinogens and cause sometimes referred to as ICU delusions, just delusional thinking. And I can remember a lot of the hallucinations and the delusional thinking. And sometimes my physical therapist would sit there and listen to me and say, I can't really remember this. Most people just have no memory of that. It's just wiped out. And I was like, well, clearly my short-term memory wasn't wiped out because I remember the thoughts I had, the spiders coming out of the season. And I learned over probably toward the end of the first week not to talk about it. Just not to talk about it because I could tell I was rattling some people.
Huh, really?
It wasn't what everyone else was seeing. I started seeing things like, you know, people would move and I'd see a big bunch of blue little butterflies flying around behind their heads and stuff, just as clear as if that was really there. And I'd never had hallucinations before, so I thought they were pretty fascinating. Anyway, once I realized they were hallucinations and nobody else was seeing these things, I just stopped talking about them. They reduced the dosage. They started, you know, moderating the dosages. And I think I came out of that delusional stuff maybe 2 or 3 weeks fully into it.
So what was your first real memory after the accident? I mean, you knew you had been in an accident, right? You said you were talking earlier. Oh, you didn't know?
I did not know. Probably one of my first memories was seeing my sister. And I remember thinking how odd it was. And I called her by my daughter's name, she says. But I do remember seeing her. And that was a real memory. And then seeing other members of my family and being in bed and not being able to roll over. And some of those really odd, but you know, the memories I had of those delusions were still influencing the way I was thinking,
mm-hmm,
because I wasn't completely sure what was a delusion.
What was real and what wasn't, right?
Yeah, at that point, though I do have some real memories now. And I remember talking to some of the nurses because they came in constantly asking questions and things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of, I think I might've been angry at first. Like, why am I not the one getting answers to questions? You know, mm-hmm, why are you doing all the asking?
Right.
And I don't, you know, I don't care what time it is or what day it is or who's president. Mm-hmm. I want to know what happened, why I'm in here, where I am, and where I've been, because one of my delusions was I was in a hospital in Florida. So like, I still had this weird idea. Where was I? What happened?
So were they telling you these things and you just weren't remembering them, or were they trying to keep it from you a little bit?
I don't think they were trying to keep it from me. I think if I had anything to counsel or suggest about dealing with trauma that involved a memory loss or like someone blanking out about the trauma, I would say you need someone, whoever the primary care person is, needs to sit down with that person. JT couldn't do it because all he did was fall apart, if you even started thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And my family, they weren't there. They couldn't fill in the gaps. Someone who knew the story needed, though, to sit down. Maybe the primary physician, somebody needed to come in and say, okay, so this is why you're here. This is what happened. This is what we're trying to do. This is why you're tied down. This is because I tried to pull out all my things at one point. This is why you've got gloves on. This is why you've got a big cast on your leg. They needed to tell me these things. So I would say they probably need to be a lot more up. And again, I don't think they were purposefully not telling me things. I don't think they get a lot of people in there that have no memory of what happened. Mm-hmm. And even when I was in the group meetings with other patients, I realized that, because most of them knew what happened. They fell off a ladder. They fell down some stairs at a party. There was a guy who fell off his tractor and it stayed in gear and ran over him. There was, you know, all kinds of accidents that put people in the trauma center. Mm-hmm. And they had patient meetings where we all sit there and talk. And I realized there weren't too many people that had no memory of their accident.
Right. But you're glad you don't have any memory of it, I would say.
I think it's helped me out now, for sure. I don't have that. I don't think I went through that, what could I have done differently? Because I just can't go back and replay it. I can't go back and replay it at all. Right. There's none of that dwelling on the accident that some people do.
So what was your prognosis when you started coming out of it and they started thinking about your long term?
I basically was a quadriplegic, psilium. Quadriplegia, and I've learned so much about these spinal cord injuries now.
Oh, I bet.
Quadriplegia is when you have an upper cervical injury that affects all four limbs. Now, 90% of them are what's called incomplete, meaning that there's some transmission of nerve impulses up and down the cord. And each person has a different level, a different kind of incomplete. Central cord incompletes, people that get bonked on the top of their head usually, and the injury comes through that, they usually regain the ability to walk in some kind of awkward fashion, but don't have any ability to use their hands. Their hands are a lot harder. They have to go through a lot of surgeries and things to be able to use them. People with mine, which was called posterior cord incomplete, I have, the prognosis is you probably won't be able to walk. You might be able to walk with assistive technology, that's what we're going to work on. I didn't at the time have as much problem with my hands as I have now, but they warned me that as the impulses come up your body, they bounce off the injury site. They don't get up to your brain. So for instance, when I broke my toes, which I did, I ran into a wall with my wheelchair, my foot sticking out, but I didn't feel them.
Right.
But I got a lot of impulses up to my injury level and then down again. And when they come down again, they cause spasms and they cause contractures. That happens with I could just be a blanket rubbing gently over my legs and I would get a spasm. Because that's just that information coming back down to me. I don't feel it going up, don't process it in my mind, but it comes back down in the form of just a random nerve impulse comes down my arms, through my hands. Over time, your fingers begin to contract in from that constant stimulation of the contracting muscle. Because at my level of injury, the contracting muscles are not as affected as the extension muscles. So my extensors didn't really, they were being overwhelmed by my contractors and I became fisted. So this hand, I got Botox shots in and it released it to this level. It's really not that bad. It's a functional hand. This hand, the Botox didn't work. So I had surgery and they tried to extend the tendons. I think they ruptured one of this finger because it doesn't bend at all.
Oh, really?
No, it's completely straight always. And this one's partially straightened, but the others I have full mobility in. And I have some prehensile thumb movement, but this finger is not, these two fingers don't really give me a grip. So when I drive, I use the hand controls on the car, these fingers. And I was told, though, this really isn't that bad because we don't realize it, but in a grip, our stronger part of our grip are those bottom two fingers. So, you know, it's really, functionally speaking, I've got decent hands for a quadriplegic. I would say that for a quadriplegic, I'm doing tremendously well.
So you started rehab there.
Right away, inpatient rehab starts. Yeah.
And what did they have?
As soon as you're stabilized and they've done the surgeries they're going to do and you've recovered from the surgeries. So about 6 weeks in, you get transferred to rehab and go inpatient rehab. So that's, you know, I had to have, my leg was completely, my femur was splintered by the impact.
That's right.
So I had big rods in my leg and a lot of metal put in my leg. And it turned out to be a couple inches shorter than the other one and it doesn't straighten all the way. So it's, if that leg had not been hurt like that, I probably would be able to walk a lot better. Right now I do, I can walk with a walker about 100 feet comfortably with a walker. I wouldn't go out in public like that because it wouldn't take much. Since I don't have middle balance, because I don't have these muscles in my torso, I don't have a lot of ability to straighten myself up if I'm bent over. Like I, it's a little wobbly. So I wouldn't want to be elbowed or jostled or something because I'd fall.
Right.
So functionally speaking, mobility for me is the wheelchair. And I way prefer the one where it's a power chair. Mm-hmm. Then I've got my hands. I tried, I can do the manual. And I used to go to the mall and go around with the walkers that show up at the mall in the morning to practice it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I did all my wall and I got to know a lot of the walkers, you know, the older folks that walk and stuff. But to me, it wasn't, you know, I didn't have any hands-free. Your shoulders begin to get sore. There's a lot of overuse injuries involved in your arms when you use manual wheelchairs for a long period of time. It's respect a person you see out on the sidewalk using a manual wheelchair because it's not easy. I went up to Seneca Loop, which is just a flat sidewalk that goes around a big loop, maybe 1.2 miles, something like that.
Yeah.
That is hard. Just the tiniest little rise feels like a mountain.
Right.
It's very difficult to get a manual chair.
I remember years ago, there used to be a guy in a manual wheelchair that would do the scenic loop all around Cherokee. I remember. Yeah. And
I think he was a paraplegic and they have a lot more upper body strength. They're a little better at the manuals.
Okay.
But still, even given that, even given that, it is a difficult thing to do.
I mean, so, it can be hard to ride up.
Pull your body and the weight of the wheelchair.
Right.
You've got the weight of the wheelchair, your whole lower part of your body, wherever your injury is. I have a lot more. I see things differently than I used to. I see people in wheelchairs, I always like do an immediate mental analysis of what their injury probably is. And I just have a lot more respect and awe for folks in wheelchairs and what they're doing. So, you know, and one of the things, all SCIs, that means spinal cord injured, people have to get past is the perception of the public, the looks you're going to get.
Sure.
I have to say, though, that one of the really remarkable and pleasant things to me was how many really good people that I meet that are helpful, that help me. They say I'm in a wheelchair and they're very helpful. I haven't really run across a lot of, you know, pettiness or short tempers or treating me like an inconvenience or an annoyance in certain situations where I'm blocking everybody in the grocery store line or blocking everybody in the restaurant from getting where they want to go or bumping into somebody's chair in the restaurant. You know, there's people are very, very kind as a group.
Has it been hard for you to accept help from people because you have been so independent?
You know, I would have guessed that about myself. And maybe in the hospital, that was part of my reputation, like just being kind of like, just let me do it. And I think at home I'm that way, and with my family I'm that way. But from strangers, I appreciate every offer of help, because I feel like it's always coming from the heart. I don't look at it as something that's a put down. I don't look at it as something that's challenging me, like, you can't do this yourself, so I need to do it for you, or anybody having any kind of ulterior message behind the offer. I will let people help me when I don't need it, because I know that it's making them feel good. I get the perception that it's making people feel good. And so I don't really care. Now, my family is a whole different story. No, I'll do it myself. Cut it out. You know, don't treat me like, you know how it is. So
right.
That's because they should know better.
So when did they let you go home? I mean, were there certain things you had to do to be able to go home?
Believe it or not, insurance determines that more than the doctors. Because insurance tells them basically when you can go home, and they want you out of there without some exceptional reason. They pretty much, their focus that 8 weeks you're in rehab is getting you ready to be taken care of at home. And it irritated the heck out of me, because I wanted to be in what was really the outpatient program, where they were practicing standing and doing arm strength and doing all those things. And all they would work on is sliding on the transfer boards and getting yourself from this position to that position to go to use the restroom, or, you know, things where they just weren't that much fun to me, frankly. No. Right. But so what they did was they trained your caregiver. You gave a caregiver. So my husband, other people that might be their mother or their sister or something, that caregiver had to then go take a course in what they needed to be able to do. And then they had to take care of you for a full day in the hospital by themselves with the staff around in case they needed help. But, you know, with that safety net underneath them, but they basically, it was training them to take care of you at home. Then when you got home, within a couple of weeks, they would send you all the information you needed to join the outpatient rehab. That's when you started the more exciting stuff, like the leg strength and the arm strength and the learning to walk. And for me, that took a long time to be able to get started on. I was very impatient because of the broken up leg. That leg had to be out of the cast and able to move a little bit before I could. So they would, like, my physical therapist understood why I was frustrated and, you know, and impatient. And he had this thing where he'd put me on my side on a board and hook my legs to electrodes. In the beginning, it's all stimulated with electrodes because you don't have any voluntary control over bending your legs. Right. So they would use electrodes hooked up to an algorithm that mimicked walking. So he'd lay me on my side, hook it all up to electrodes. So I'm lying down, not standing. And then my legs would kind of do this weird walking thing. You know, like in 10th grade biology, when you do something and the frog's leg would move. Well, it's kind of like that. I felt like that frog on the dissecting table. My legs are like marching along, but I have absolutely no conscious, you know, awareness of this.
Yeah, you're like, I'm not doing that.
Finally, I got to graduate to where they hang you up in this harness over a treadmill. And they do the same thing. It's the electrical stimulation. So for the first few weeks, you're just like watching yourself in this mirror in front of you doing things with, you have no, you know, you're not doing it. You don't have any voluntary or affirmative control over what's going on with your body, but you're watching your legs kind of walk. That then turns into where people, they take off the electrodes, and it's all about retraining your reflexes and your walking reflex motions. And then they have assistants come in, these young people who I really, really liked. A lot of them were just interns for PT therapy or students at U of L who volunteered, but it's really, really nice young people who had to go through a lot of training to do this. And they would sit there and move your feet in a pattern they had been taught with pressure points they had been taught in a walking motion while the treadmill moved. And again, you're just watching yourself in the mirror in the mirror. They put in front of you. Yeah. And the harness is holding you up. So in the beginning, it's holding up only 10% of your weight is actually on the treadmill. And you're thinking, wow, this is really kind of easy. And then they start lowering, you know, you're putting more and more of your body weight down. And pretty soon you're going, oh my God. And I would say that's the funniest thing to get used to as a quad is, because there's a disconnect, kind of a disambiguation between your brain and your body,
your legs, they feel heavy. It feels like you're carrying them, like they're like they're dead weight. You can feel that you're carrying them, but it just feels like this tremendously heavy appendage. And to walk is exhausting.
Right.
To walk just 10 feet on a with a walker is absolutely exhausting, because I'm lifting these legs as if they are
dead weight.
Weights attached to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And everything is a little bit like that. Now, I probably have, say, 60% of my arms. Mm-hmm. And the parts I don't have, it's kind of weird because I don't have about half of a triceps. I have more of some other muscles. So it's all like a lopsided, imbalanced strength that I've come to get used to. But it's weird. It's really weird.
Right.
But it, again, it has that weird sensation of some of these parts aren't really mine, and some of them are all integrated into one appendage. And for my legs, none of them are mine. I don't feel like they're a part of me, other than I feel like there's a huge weight there. And so, but they train those reflexes again, so that when you feel certain points with the walker, you know, you put your foot on the ground, it steps, your foot steps, and you can kind of guide the whole process with the walker. Again, I probably had more problems than I otherwise would have because of the broken leg and the degree of that break. It's pretty, if you just looked up, if you just Google that kind of distal femur fracture, say that three times, it alone prevents people from walking in some cases, because you have no femur and they can't attach an artificial knee or anything to a femur that's been completely shattered like that. Instead of a femur, I have a big metal thing that goes from my hip down to my knee, screws through that to anchor it, and then some wires holding my kneecap on, which had been torn off by the impact.
Wow.
At my knee, there's a plate and some screws. If you look on the x-ray, screws that go through. So it's a very, almost like a rudimentary looking rebuild.
Contraption. Right.
Compared to what you would think they could do, considering they have artificial hips and artificial knees and all these cool things, but they can't do that. If you don't have a femur, in order to have either an artificial hip or an artificial knee, they have to have a nice hard bone to drill into and to anchor those big conical pieces of metal that go into there for either a knee or a hip. And I don't have those. I mean, my femur was pretty much disintegrated. And because I was 56 at the time of the injury, and because now that is a non-weight bearing area of my body, it was not healing the way you would, you know, want it to heal. It's not all coming back together in some solid mass.
Right.
I had to put magnets on it. Oh my God, it was crazy. But now it's at the point where I can kind of toe walk on that foot and walk normally with my other leg with a walker. And go, like, you know, if I had to 100 feet or something, I can't, there's not really a situation where I have to do that other than when I'm showing off for my mom or something.
Yeah.
But.
But you can.
I can.
Yeah.
It's not really a functional walk.
Yeah.
But I would never get up in the restaurant or something and do that. But
right.
I can do that. Yeah.
Right. And I know I know you can swim.
Yes. And I didn't. Okay. When I first got to Florida, we had a pool. It probably took me a week to get the courage just to get in the hot tub part of the pool. And just kind of like get in there, because I had to move myself. And again, I'm so much of my body feels like dead weight and heavy weight. I just thought if I got into the part where you really need to know, be able to say at least tread water, I wouldn't be able to hold my body up. And really, if I'm just doing like what you might consider a treading water position, leg down, it does feel like pulls me under. But in the prone position where you're swimming, I realized I still had enough strength in my arms to swim. Just dragging my legs behind me, which probably indicates why I was a pathetic swimmer, because I probably never used my legs that well.
Right.
But they were never something that helped my swimming, and I'm still dragging them behind me.
Right.
But
see, again, you were being prepared.
That's right. That's right. So of all the things that I used to be able to do, the thing that I hated the most was swimming. And now it's the thing I probably do the best in terms of I can get from one end of a pool to another.
Yeah.
So every day I do, or not every day, really, that would be an exaggeration, but probably every other day I swim my little pool, which is 5 yards long, 120 times. Yeah. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
If I had an Olympic sized pool in my backyard, I might. And if there weren't strange animals living in my canal, I might go up and down the canal. But a friend of mine who's a master swimmer got me one of those ropes that you anchor and then you put on a harness. It seemed like a good idea. But with my dragging legs, just didn't, it didn't feel right. I'm better off swimming in a regular pool than trying to do that, that harness swimming.
How did you feel the first time that you were able to do that?
Pretty excited.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt.
It's a feeling of euphoria. Just like, you know, when I swim, so I'm calling JT, I have to go find my phone, and getting in and out of the pool by myself is a trip, because what we did was we put dog stairs by the side of the hot tub, and that sort of went right into the stairs in the pool. So I transfer from my wheelchair to the top of the dog stairs, and then kind of bump down the dog stairs all the way into the pool. That's how I get in my pool, and I can get in and out by myself. Getting awesome. Out, I just reversed. So I had to go get JT to show him, and he, of course, filmed it on his iPhone. Mm-hmm. And it was really exciting to just, because I'm moving of my own accord, by mm-hmm. myself, independently, mm-hmm. without a machine, without an assistive device. And that was really exciting. Mm-hmm. And it's still exciting.
Hell yeah, so, it's exciting. I saw that video. I was like, you've got to be freaking kidding me. Look at her.
I can swim. Yeah. With about 70% of your arms and the same zero legs I've always swum with, I can swim.
Do you feel like you will progress even more? Or are you at kind of a place where this is you're going to be?
No. That's something a lot of SCI patients are told that's a fallacy. Like everything you're going to get back, you're going to get back in the first year. Sometimes
I remember you telling me that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they tell you. That's just not true. In fact, today I texted JT because I was excited. I said, you know what? I still get on give in order for bones to stay healthy at our age, you're going to get really bad osteoporosis if you never go weight bearing. Mm-hmm. So I'll just stay in there with the walker, just stand there so that I have some weight bearing on my leg bones mm-hmm. and going up through my spine. Well, I'm standing there today and I'm like, suddenly my lower back kicked in, like it reawoke or something. And mm-hmm. I was able to stand up very straight, mm-hmm. which I'd never been able to do before. And that was this morning when I was on the walker and I was like, man, and it's amazing how much easier it is to stand when you stand straight versus uh-huh. bent forward a little bit. So two things have to happen for that. Your hip flexors have to be a lot stronger and working and engaged. Right. And your lower back muscles, which were the ones that kicked in this morning, have to be strong enough to pull your abdomen up. Right. And so this morning I was able to, and it's been what, 2.5 years, more than 2.5 years, going on right. 3 years in September. So
when that happened this morning, were you like, it just felt natural, or were shocked?
So much better. Yeah. I was very shocked.
Yeah.
I was very shocked. I was like, I'm actually standing straight. So then I'm trying to wiggle myself around so I could see it in the mirror from the side. Uh-huh. It's like, I haven't seen myself standing straight forever.
That's awesome.
And then, so then I'm like trying to like let go every so often, like, you know, like let go. Like, am I going to be able to just stand here again? Mm-hmm. I think I'd be able to do it really easily if the other leg, but I had my lift on the bottom of my shoe. So I had a little more on the ground. So I was able to stand for like a few seconds, just stand there looking at myself standing straight. Then I always have music on when I do this too. So now, then I'm like getting really excited and I'm like, maybe I can dance in my walker. So I'm picking up the walker and like moving it around kind of to the music. It's pretty pathetic dancing, but you know, if we can define dance broadly as moving to music with your whole body instead of just like your arms or something.
Yeah.
I think that could qualify as dancing. I texted JT and I said, you know what? I could just stand straight this morning. And he knew right away because he's seen me stand.
Yeah.
And I always kind of bent over like my ass is sticking out behind me.
Yeah.
So definitely it was better. That just, your point is well taken, that most people think that the progress has an ending point. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it does. I think it's very fast in the beginning because what's happening is your inflammation is reducing. And during that period, a lot that you're going to get comes back. And right. then you have the therapy kicking in and you're learning techniques. And then, you know, your injury is taking some away from you through that period of time too. Mm-hmm. Just because you had it today doesn't mean you're going to have it in 3 months, because the contracture is continuing. And you have to continually be stretching and working on that, working on your extensors to make sure they're not overwhelmed by the contractors.
Yeah.
Or you'll end up all like curled up.
Yeah.
So you have to continually work on that. And then, you know, I think that the nervous system is struggling to heal itself, when you're incomplete, there's some communication going on, and then it just continues to root around it, do whatever it can to increase that bandwidth that you've got. And I think that continues.
Well, you know, and I mean, you're a testament because I mean, you work on these things every day. I mean, you standing up straight today is not just some freak thing. I mean, you work hard at
every single day. I stand and stretch, and in the pool, I can really work out at it. But yeah, I work at it all the time. And then to suddenly have your lower back muscles kick in where, you know, it's funny too, because I feel them. Not in a way you ever feel them when you're like all intact neurologically, but you really feel them. And I'm like, oh my God. And I was like kicking me up into a straight position. That's so yeah, awesome. It's just another connection was made. Something happened so that all the work that I'd done keeping those muscles there was taken advantage of. It's one of the mistakes people make. And one of the things that, makes me a little bit upset with the medical personnel that'll tell people, oh, you know, don't expect a lot to happen. This was they give up working out those muscles. If they're never going to be using them, why are they working so hard to at least passively work them out?
Right.
You need to keep the muscles, because otherwise, if you ever do get the nerves back, if you ever do get the connection back, you won't know. You won't know.
Well, and then so, also, I mean, there's a lot of hope in that too. I mean, if you're working hard and little things start to happen, it's kind of like, oh, well, what's next?
And again, it's that piecemeal thing that I was telling you with the Ironman training. You just have to parse it out into little tiny bits, and it's not even necessarily linear, and it's not necessary that it's always forward, but over time, it's going to go forward. And you have to learn. One of the things Ironman training teaches you is patience. And you have to have that patience and not lose that hope.
Right.
It needs to stay that carrot out there is, you know, you're not going to get back to where you were, but you can set your sights on something you would really love to do.
That's what I was going to ask you. What are your goals now?
So the goals are simple. I want to hold my grandson's hand and, you know, walk with him somewhere. I would love to be able to do that. I would love to be able to take care of him by myself, to be able to give my daughter a break and not feel like they're worried about my ability to do that. I want to be able to do it. They're really simple things. They're not like, you know, any grandiose things. They're very simple, down to earth things that maybe at one point, you know, when you're not thinking of those as goals, but as desires, now they're really actually goals you have to work toward. You know,
right.
I want to be able to do those things. I want to be able to lift him off the ground when he's a toddler and put him in my lap, you know, and give him a ride in my chair, but I got to be able to lift him and put him in my lap, that kind of thing.
So everything that's happened, I know, you know, it hasn't just affected you. It's affected JT and it's affected your whole family. How have your relationships with your family changed?
Well, you know, my sisters, we've always been super close. And just everybody rushes in to help. They were great. And I think the person who's probably shouldered the burden of change and the burden of someone else undergoing a traumatic injury is JT. And, you know, it's not that, you know, I say sometimes, you know, it's not all bad. And I think in some ways it brought us closer. I think it sort of forces the issue of intimacy when you have to get down to the nitty gritty, dirty, bad, whatever, that someone's body is completely given up on them and you're helping them with just the most basic of everything.
Right.
It really makes you closer in a lot of ways. Now, is he decided to start, I think one of the things that helped for him personally, because you know JT, he had quit writing for 10 years. I couldn't get him to go out and ride his bike. And he started up again after my injury, partly, I think, to give himself a break from everything, but also because he had a newfound respect for being able to do something. And to be able to do something and choose not to became something, you know, like a demerit on your conscience. Yeah, you know, it's like, that's my God.
That's very interesting.
Anything to get out there and do that.
Right.
And here I am perfectly able to do it. And I'm just wasting my time. I'm not doing the things that I loved to do for so long. And I need to go back and do that. So he started riding at least mountain biking, and he still tries to get out a lot. But, you know, obviously not bike racing kind of biking, but just getting out and riding his bike with other guys sometimes and that kind of thing. So I overall, you know, when I look at it, I think it hasn't been a bad thing for us or for him or for me.
That's great. Yeah. You were talking before we started recording about how, you know, you have to look at it, that it's not all bad, that there have been good things too. So
yeah, it's a huge change. And some of those changes, most of them personal to me, and most of them having to do with your body's ability to, you know, operate at the level it used to. Those are bad. You know, that's, you know, let's just face it. Those are negatives, but there's a lot of positives. There's a lot more. There's just a lot more that you can focus on that I never did before. I see things a completely different way. I see people a different way. I am, you asked what some of my goals are. I'm writing a couple of books. And one of them,
I was going to ask you about that, because you mentioned the fact that you were going to write a book, and I was going to ask you if you did that.
It's going to take me for freaking ever. It's but that I understand that's not unusual. That first one takes a while because you know, you're really trying to figure out how to step into your audience size,
right.
And
how
to develop a character and at the same time tell the story you wanted to tell, but make it something people want to read because you've got some character development in there. You're not just writing a textbook. So it's, you know, it's a challenge. But I do feel like, you know, once you get through the first one, then I think after that, it'll be a little easier. But but anyway, so that's, you know, part of what I'm doing. And it's fun. It's a fun process. Hopefully I ever get that book out. But I figure the first one's going to take a few years. So you'll get a signed edition. But I'm not using my name.
Oh, you're not?
It won't be by Denise Everett. No.
Really? How come?
I don't have a pseudonym. I have to write through. It's almost like acting in a way. Like when I was a kid, I think I was a lot more social and a lot more open and I don't know, when I had a bag on my head, when I was in a costume. And I feel that way writing too. Like I don't want to write in my voice or like with me being the engineer of what's coming out. I want it to be a costume. I want it to be a different name. And then it comes easier. It's easier.
Yeah. No, I get it. I wrote one script that was a little intense. I'm kind of like, if anybody really read this and they know me, they'd be like, what? That came out of you? That's kind of,
Yeah.
So, no, I get it.
Yeah. I need to be in a costume. Yeah. So I'll send you a copy, but you know, it won't be my name.
I can't wait.
It'll be a few years.
Yeah, it'll show up. It'll be some name. I don't know. I'll be like, who
is sending me this book? Is this a book of the month or something? Well, hopefully. No, it's not. I'll probably be one of those people who has to self-publish for a while. We'll see.
So I want to mention something. When we were messaging back and forth about doing this podcast, you had me in tears, and I told you you did. And I actually mentioned it to a close friend of ours, Marla, and she also had tears when I told her what you said. But I'm going to paraphrase here, but you were talking about your new grandchild, and he's your first, and you had just mentioned him. And you were talking about how having a grandchild gives you this weird inner joy and that it impacts the relationship that you have with your child. And then you said, and this just gives me goosebumps. You said that you are so glad that you lived to be able to hold that baby.
Yes. Yes.
And it just, I mean, even now I'm like shaking just saying that, because just the fact that you lived and that baby will know you is the most incredible gift.
Yes. Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And of all the positives that have come from the therapy and from just getting past the accident, that is the most compelling and the most significant.
Yeah.
And now you made me cry.
I'm sorry.
I mean, but yeah, you're absolutely right. That is just to have that little life and to be able to experience his life, mm-hmm. and to hold him, to look in those eyes. That's incredible.
Yeah. Cause that you very easily could have not been here.
Oh, very easily.
All of that.
I mean, I died twice, they said. And that the only reason I made it through that helicopter ride was because my heart was as strong as it was. So, yeah, very easily would not have been here for that. And it's so precious, and it's not something any amount of money can buy. It's not something that, you know, you can make or make happen. It's a gift, and it's a blessing, and it's just an unbelievable. Like I said, the inner joy, you hear people say that pet phrase all the time, like, oh yeah, nothing like having a grandchild because you can just give them back. But see, that's not what's cool about it. That's not the profound feeling you get holding a grandchild is. Mm-hmm. It is something about you are now connected to the future, and you're holding it in your arms, and, you know, you're looking it in the eyes, and you're hoping that you're going to live long enough too to have some influence on that vision, not just the eyes, but on the vision that comes from those eyes. And so it's a very profound feeling, and it's maybe the epitome of motherhood in a way, or parenthood.
So how has it changed the relationship with your daughter?
That really does change things.
Yeah.
They look at you in a different way, and you kind of sense before they even have to be, you know, they will, because you did. And it's almost one of the reasons you want your kids to have kids is you want them to understand you better, in your relationship better. But when it happens, it's just as life changing when you see how much you change when they change. Mm-hmm. As everything in life, all relationships are an interaction and a dance. And when your daughter or your son has a child and they see you differently, mm-hmm. and they talk to you differently, and they want you to come around, and for things that they never in a million years would have wanted to sit down and talk to you necessarily, mm-hmm. they would have tolerated it, but not like solicited it.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, respecting the wisdom you might have and the experiences you can share, and just that look in their eyes changes you too. It's just, your relationship has become deeper,
right?
And on both sides. And I think that's another thing that, you know, grandchildren do.
That's beautiful. So I want to ask you, because obviously there have been a lot of hard days. What has been something that has given you the desire to live and to push through and to do everything that you can to recover as well as you can?
So aside from the fact that I was determined to be a continuing part of my children's lives and that kind of family thing, I think there were times when thinking I've got to be able to get back out into nature. I've got to get out there and be a part of the universe. I need to be a part of the productive world. I need to be a part of the world. I think we all have that inner drive. You might call it, I don't know, something like the drive to stay alive. It's more than that. It's a drive to be a part of something bigger than yourself, mm-hmm. be a cog in the wheel, be a wheel, be whatever, you know, to just feel alive, to see the colors and to hear the sounds and to interact with the world. Those things I never gave up on and still need. And I think that on my darkest days, it would be more anger at myself. I never gave up on myself. And that's why I get angry at myself. I'm not one of those people that is going to let me get by easily. And so when I'm mad at myself, it's because I haven't achieved a level I wanted to achieve, or I've backslid on something, or I've just not done what I promised myself I would do in terms of the long-term therapy. I get angry because I know that I can do this. And that just keeps me going. My dark days are never about, I've never like just thought that it's not worth it or giving up or anything like that. There's nothing that I think it's the world's a beautiful place, right. And being a part of this universe is very important.
Yeah. So I know there are a lot of women, and the reason I wanted to have you on is because you have that belief, and because you're so inspirational, but there's a lot of women who over a certain age are, you know, not happy with how things are going in their life and are determined or thinking they should quit or just stop or not push through with whatever that they're doing. What is your best advice for women to just keep going?
You've got to get out of that mental rut that is leading you to feelings of despair and giving up. And often that takes just forcing yourself, getting a little angry at yourself. Get angry at yourself. Go out there, even if go out means, you know, visualize it through media and see how much there is in the world that's beautiful and real and good. And you've got to find a way to get back to that and get angry at yourself and make yourself take that first step. And just like any other plan you've ever made in your life, break it into little bites that you can digest, but take that first one. That first one is so very, very important. Mm-hmm. And the rewards will build. The first day might not seem like much, but it builds and it builds. And then it surprises you and hits you upside the head like a grandchild. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't in the plan in therapy. That wasn't like, okay, this is your goal out here to someday hold your grandson. No, that's one that comes up and you just go, this is what it's all about, really.
Right, right.
You know, there's so many cool, special surprises out there right around the corner, but you've got to get to that corner.
Right. Oh,
you've got to do it.
I love that. You got to get to that corner. Oh,
yeah.
That's awesome.
And my best advice is get angry at yourself, because that's what I do. Mm-hmm. Kick yourself in the ass and say,
I do that a lot.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. I think that's something all of us racers and people that, you know, are achievement oriented people and then are faced with challenges do.
Yeah.
We regroup, and just like we did out there on that freaking mountain trying to climb a hill.
Yeah.
And you just double down. You never get off the bike.
No, hell no.
You never quit. You just double down on that hill.
You may be really slow, but you're not getting off that bike.
But you can't go down the hill until you get to the top of the damn mountain and then have some fun.
Yeah.
Then you can stop pedaling for a little while. Right. But no, you just got to double down and make it happen.
Is there anything that you want to wrap up with? Anything you want to say or message or anything?
You know, not in particular, just that I think this is a great podcast. I think you're reaching a big audience. There's a huge audience of people that I think women that, you know, do reach our own midlife crisis. And I don't think it has anything to do with menopause as much as it has to do with our cultural idea of aging women.
Yeah.
And we almost treat aging as a disease. Mm-hmm. And instead of just this natural process that we can embrace and maximize and live with and make it work for us. And I think your podcast is very going to be to a lot of people, I would think, very beneficial in that respect.
Oh, well, I hope so. And
thanks for inviting me.
I am so excited that you are here. First of all, I'm excited that you are here.
Yeah, that's it.
That and then one. I'm excited that you're here on the podcast.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And I'm excited about both of those things too today. So
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah. And this has been awesome. I thank you so much for being on the podcast today, because I know people are going to love listening to you. And then hopefully they'll get angry at themselves and get their ass up. Get moving.
Get up. Get going. Yeah.
One step. Yep. Get to the corner.
Yeah. You can't turn it till you get to it.
That's right. Thank you, Denise. All right.
Thank you, Les. Take care.
My friend Denise amazes me. I mean, her will to live and never giving up on herself is a message that we can all learn so much from. I want to wrap up this podcast with a little paraphrase of something that she said, and it's this. Get out of your rut of despair. Get a little mad at yourself. Take that first step. It is so very, very important. The rewards will build and someday will surprise you with something you never could have dreamed of. There are so many surprises out there around the corner, but you have got to get to that corner first. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend. Tell somebody about it. Take a picture. Post it on your social media so that someone can see it. Because Denise's story, I know, can help someone out there. So it's up to all of us to spread that news. And as always, thank you so much for taking your precious time to listen today. It means so much to me. Mike and I will return this Friday with another podcast read of the Friday Night Beer blog. And I can tell you he's very excited about it. Like, the blog is posted every Friday evening on my website, llmcshane.com. And if you'd like to get email reminders, you can sign up there on my website and for a little email reminder and links on Saturday morning. I send those out. I'm also on Instagram at llmcshane, and I'm giving out some daily motivations if you feel like you would like to receive those or see those. Okay, everybody, till next time, hugs all around. Bye.